I didn't put my cats away. Give me one second. I'm just going to go shut the door on them.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Employment data has started to come out from a number of states reflecting America's new reality. And the rise in unemployment looks unprecedented. Overnight, the labor market has gone from historically strong to experts questioning just how bad it could get. Markets have also been racking up steep losses for weeks now. It's clear that the economic toll of the coronavirus is going to be dramatic. So on today's podcast, we're going to dig into the data and talk about the scale of the damage, who it's most likely to affect, and how our government is responding. So here with me to do that are senior writer Amelia Thompson-DeVoe. Hey, Amelia.
Hey, Galen.
As we are all reorienting ourselves towards covering the coronavirus, Amelia is going to be focusing on the economic impact. So Amelia, we'll be checking in with you on that periodically. Also here with us is Tara Sinclair, professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University. She's also a senior fellow at the job site Indeed. Hi, Tara. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Galen. Hi, Amelia.
So, Tara, let's begin with the broad picture. From where you sit, what is the state of the American economy?
Well, right now, we're really in a huge state of uncertainty. And obviously, there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of things changing very, very quickly. And I think what everybody's looking at right now is how fast are things changing? Where are things going? And when is this feeling of the bottom falling out going to settle in and we can really start to assess the damage?
Is there any question whether we're in a recession right now?
Well, it really depends on how we think about defining a recession, because it's clear we are in a very different economic state than we were in even just a few weeks ago. But the question is this a recession or is this something different? Because we're really choosing to put our economy in a sudden stop in order to protect our public health. That's a very different type of economic condition than really we've ever seen before.
Yeah, just to set the baseline, what was the state of our economy before COVID-19?
Well, I mean, we can look back to just a few weeks ago when we got the last employment numbers for the month of February, and we were surprised by strong employment growth, a low unemployment rate, and we were really reading the economy as really pretty strong. There were still some underlying issues, but overall, we'd been in this 10-plus year economic recovery from the global financial crisis. But even as we were receiving those numbers in the first week of March, we knew that things were going to look very different. And even over the past week, things have started to really look very, very different and very, very frightening.
I mentioned that numbers are starting to come out. Looking at the data that we've gotten so far, what are the most concerning trends that you see?
Well, obviously, what everybody's talking about is the unemployment claims numbers that we got on Thursday. So they jumped by 70%. So we're at a two-year high in terms of unemployment claims. And the scary thing is that those numbers are through Friday of the previous week. And we've heard from so many employers and state groups as well that we're really just seeing the flows happening to unemployment this week. And so we're really looking fearfully forward to the numbers that we're going to get next week, because it really looks like there's a huge shift in terms of who's going to have a job in the next few weeks.
Amelia, you've been reporting out who this is impacting the most. What have you learned?
I've been talking to a number of workers in different sectors and in sort of different financial positions who are being hit by the immediate effects of this. And one of the things that's just stood out to me immediately is kind of how broad a range of folks are being affected. Obviously, there are a few sectors where we've seen just the economy basically coming to a halt. So restaurants, the hospitality industry, the tourism industry is generally not doing well. You know, if you work for an airline, I've talked to several airline employees who have been temporarily laid off or had their hours cut back really significantly. And the issue is really that you know, these jobs have tend to have a few things in common. They're not jobs where you can work from home. They require in-person interaction. And often these are jobs that are not well-paying to begin with. So they're people, you know, the people who are facing economic uncertainty, don't have an income for the next couple weeks, are not people who necessarily have a financial cushion to fall back on. So they're wondering, you know, I've talked to several people who are wondering, how am I going to pay my April rent? And they're also not people who typically have paid leave. So, you know, we can talk more about what some of the policy responses are. That's something that is starting to be addressed on a federal level. But I think the thing that's just really standing out is these are people who, many of whom are quite economically vulnerable, and the suddenness of it means that they've had no time to prepare. So one conversation that really stood out to me was I talked to one young man who works as a bartender, and he said, you know, last month, I actually paid off all of my credit card bills, and I was really proud of myself for having done that. And now I wish that I had just paid the minimums because I wish I had that money in my bank account. So that's the situation that a lot of workers are finding themselves in.
Are you seeing any trends across ages? It seems like anecdotally, I've heard that a lot of these more gig economy jobs are jobs that like younger people have taken up. Is that borne out in the data?
Yeah, so I had a piece on the site earlier this week with Ryan Best, who's one of our visual journalists, and we were looking basically at sort of what are some of the broad characteristics of the workers that are going to be hit hardest first, and they do tend to be younger. I didn't mention this, but I'm hearing also from a lot of independent contractors, freelancers, people who work in what we'd call the gig economy, and those people, you know, typically can't apply for unemployment insurance, so there's like a big question mark about how they're even going to get income replacement compensation during this time. They tend to either be quite young, or also this is a group that's a smaller category of the workforce, but it's quite worrying to see that the very oldest workers are also more likely to be in this position. So workers over the age of 65. And I've talked to a few older folks who work in grocery stores or who work as domestic workers, and they're basically going to keep going to work until someone tells them not to, but they're also in this higher risk category. So to be clear, they're a pretty small slice of the overall workforce, but that's sort of an especially worrying and vulnerable category. But yes, you're right, Galen, that young folks are also being hit quite hard by this.
Tara, there's a lot of different data points to look at when people are thinking about the state of the economy. We have the unemployment figures that we're starting to get out and that you talked about. There are the markets, there's GDP. What is the most meaningful at a time like this to look at in order to understand the state of our economy?
Well, I think we've got to think about two things. We've got to think about what's the most meaningful, but also what's the most timely, because a lot of the meaningful data that we would normally like to look at, I'm a macroeconomist, I like to look at those big numbers like GDP and unemployment rates and those sorts of things. But you know, these days, even the unemployment claims that we think of as being incredibly timely are a week delayed, and a week feels like months at this point with the data. And so with that in mind, I think we really are looking at all different sources to get a sense of what's going on. You know, this is where anecdotes do start to play more of a role, where information from metro areas, from state agencies, even these preliminary estimates are just being greedily grabbed and eaten up by people who are really trying to get a sense of where things are going. And of course, a lot of private companies have also been working on developing their own data sources. I think people have really enjoyed working with the Open Table data that has been released, and people can see what's been happening in terms of restaurant reservations on their site. And of course, the site that I work with, Indeed, has been putting out information, particularly around job postings on their site, because that's something that can get updated every day. Whereas if we're looking at information coming from the government on job openings, that tends to come out with a 6-week plus delay. And that's just way too long to be able to get a sense of things. And you know, what we're seeing from all of these preliminary data is a pretty big turn, even just in the last week, both in terms of unemployment claims, in terms of job postings on the Indeed site. Everything is just really shifting very quickly. In the Indeed data, we're seeing things that are really just slowing down dramatically. This should be a time of year when a lot of businesses are ramping up their hiring. You know, we've got all the college graduates, the high school graduates that are going to be coming in the market, they're starting to look for jobs. There should be all sorts of job openings coming online, and they're not there for lots of different industries.
Yeah. What have you seen specifically in the Indeed data that sticks out to you?
Well, I mean, I think the most striking is, you know, perhaps also the one that we've been most aware of is the directly affected. So thinking about, you know, leisure and hospitality jobs. This should be a huge ramp up time of year, but instead, you know, job postings have been flat. They looked similar to January. And so that's a really big difference for people who would normally be getting work this time of year. But I should point out too that there are other groups that are seeing, you know, big gains. So if we look at what's happening for warehouse workers, for example, you know, Amazon has done a big announcement that they're hiring a whole bunch because they're expecting there to be a lot of need, you know, for warehouse workers, for deliveries. And, you know, so far, you know, grocery and those sorts of essential retail have been doing very, very well. And of course, you know, there's going to be huge healthcare needs. But I don't know how we transition, you know, people who were, you know, hospitality and restaurants, leisure workers, and translate for them into being, you know, ramped up hospital workers when everybody is in, you know, emergency mode.
Maybe this is an impossible question to ask, but what are you expecting to see the next time you see jobs numbers? Like, just how bad do you think this could get?
Well, see, this is what we all want to know, right? We all want a clear forecast. But to be able to make some kind of prediction about where the economy is going, we would normally base it on historical patterns or things we've seen before. And we haven't seen anything like this before. You know, if we think about what kind of analogies we might want to do, right? So people would talk about, you know, bringing together some of the biggest natural disasters, plus 9/11, plus the global financial crisis, plus now people are talking World War II. So if you bring all of those different analogies together, we don't know how to weight them and really be able to make a good prediction about what next month's numbers are going to look like, which is why we're all just grabbing on to every number as it comes to try and give us a sense. But this also depends on what the government response is going to look like in the coming months, because right now we're focused on those directly affected workers who are being laid off. But we have to also worry about those secondary spillover effects that can happen, where when those workers are laid off and they're not buying, then the other people that they would otherwise be buying from will lose their jobs. And that's where we're really watching very carefully to see how big those effects are.
According to reporting from the New York Times, the Labor Department asked states not to release specific numbers about unemployment claims before the national numbers come out next week. Why did they do that? Is that normal?
My understanding is that there's two different sets of numbers that are being debated about here. One is these very preliminary numbers, and another is like the state's more official releases. And so my understanding is that there is a concern about preliminary numbers being released if they haven't been vetted. And that's something that I am also concerned about. If we look at all the numbers, you know, anybody who sees a bad number, which could come out for a number of reasons, there could be all sorts of volatility in the way that we're gathering data and in the way that information is coming in. And so you could imagine that somebody might say like, oh, wow, look at this amazing drop. And it could really spark fear. And then we find out that, oh, that's because it's an incomplete piece of information and we actually do need the rest of that survey to be completed. And otherwise, we're going to miss, you know, really undercount some people and it might look much worse than we think.
So for anybody who's used to listening to us talk about polling in this podcast, in some ways, we're still in the middle of the data collection period. The poll is still out in the field. And it's really just going to take some time before we get a full picture of what this all looks like. So, you know, it is an interesting comparison to trying to collect, you know, public opinion polling. Mm-hmm. I do also want to talk about what the government is doing, what kind of precedents there are for it, and what the American public thinks about those kinds of interventions. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Lightstream is geared towards folks who carry a balance on their credit cards and whose cards come with high interest rates. It's easy to lower your interest rate and save with a Lightstream credit card consolidation loan. You can get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and there are absolutely no fees. You can even get your money as soon as the day that you apply. Apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and Congress has passed one new law in response to the crisis and are now working on another. So, Amelia, what was in that first law and what are they working on now?
This is the kind of first wave of the economic response. And I think what we're clearly going to see over the coming weeks and months is that Congress is sort of dealing with this in pieces because it's hard to get a political consensus around a lot of this stuff. And they're sort of trying to triage a little bit. So the first law was focusing on things like how do we get emergency paid leave into place? There was also a provision that was providing emergency funds to states' unemployment insurance programs, which have been completely flooded with claims. You know, we're talking about these numbers that we've been seeing. The practical effect of that is that the websites of state unemployment insurance agencies have crashed. I've personally talked to a number of workers who were laid off days ago and haven't been able to submit their claim yet because they can't get through on the phone lines. We've seen huge lines. Just the capacity of our unemployment insurance infrastructure is just not, you know, this is an unprecedented scale, and we need to ramp up quickly. And so that was part of the focus of this first bill, was just getting a little more money to the states, or a lot more money to the states, to try to actually have the capacity to deal with this. The next wave is focusing on something that we've suddenly been hearing a lot about, which is direct payments to Americans. And this is something that is going to be at the center of the political debate. The Trump administration for a while had been advocating for measures like a payroll tax holiday. They seem to have kind of backed off of that. What I've heard from the economists I've talked to is that they were not that excited about something like that as a response, because it's a payroll tax, so it is not going to help anyone who has lost their job. And it's also something that sort of takes some, will have an effect over a longer period of time. And what policymakers are really trying to do is figure out how to get money into people's bank accounts now, so that the people I've been talking to, can actually pay their April and May rent. So the Republican proposal that was just unveiled on Thursday includes one version of this direct payments to Americans plan. And it also includes some other provisions like relief for corporations, which is something else that is likely going to be controversial. And so I think what we're going to see over the coming week is just a lot of political debate about how do we get aid to individuals and businesses, small businesses, and then also corporations in a timely way. And that's something where, you know, there kind of might be some political agreement, a little bit of bipartisan agreement about these direct payments. But even when you start to scratch below the surface, politicians are not necessarily on the same page about the best way to do this.
I want to dig in a little bit more into the concept of direct payments to Americans. But before we get into that specifically, broadly, Tara, what do we know about what the most effective solution is to a situation like this? We've mentioned repeatedly that this is unprecedented. To a certain extent, I understand that we just don't know. But drawing on some of our past experiences, what would you say?
Well, I mean, there's two things that we're looking at. We're thinking about how we're going to help people who are hurt right now. And then we're also thinking about macroeconomic stimulus to prevent or at least lessen the medium to long-term impacts of what's going on right now. And those could be very different policies. But if we're thinking first about helping people right now, it really we want to find out whatever is the most timely, politically possible way to get money into people's hands. And that seems to have varied somewhat, but this is where the push for direct payments to Americans really comes in.
Tara, on that point, is it a good idea to give everyone money, even people who haven't been affected so far? What's the argument for doing that instead of targeting it to people who specifically have lost their jobs?
Well, I think the issue here is we've got a trade-off between timely and targeted. And given the emergency situation that we find ourselves in now, that trade-off really matters. You know, it's already hard for legislators to agree and put together a bill and get it passed and make those decisions. But then to identify and target particular people that are impacted, that adds another layer. And so if we're thinking about ways to get the money out there quickly, just saying all Americans is more timely. And there is a sense in which there's the potential for kind of addressing these inequalities later on in future packages and future tax bills. But for that timeliness aspect, anything where we're trying to narrow who's going to get the money takes more time to agree on and also takes more time to implement.
One of the arguments I've heard, too, for this kind of broad strategy of just sending checks to everyone is that we can kind of make some guesses about who's being most affected. But, we just had a long conversation about how fast this is moving, how we're not really sure what all of these numbers are. And so those guesses about who to target might be kind of imperfect. And what I've heard from several people I've talked to is we should be kind of erring on the side of maximalism rather than minimalism at this point. The risk of doing too little might be greater than the risk of doing too much. And I would just add one more thing, which is that I've heard from other folks that I've talked to that, it doesn't have to be an either or. We can do the broader, less targeted strategy of sending checks out to Americans. And we can also think about how do we go about bolstering the unemployment insurance system so that it can better support the people who are perhaps quite literally most in need of help because they are losing their jobs and therefore qualify for unemployment insurance. So, I think the checks has kind of emerged as like the shiny political thing that everyone is focusing on. But there are really a lot of things that I've heard in my conversations with experts that they're suggesting we should be considering. And, it's not like we can only do one of them.
Yeah. What are the specifics of what's being proposed as far as direct cash payments are concerned? And what are the political sticking points, if there are any at this point?
All right. Are there political sticking points? So what the Republican bill or the proposal that was just released is more targeted in these direct payments. So it has a phase out for people who make more money if you're on the higher income end of the spectrum. Based on your 2018 income, you might not get any money at all. On the other hand, the people at the very lowest end, the people who don't have any income tax liability, which is quite a significant portion of the population, also get less money. They don't get no money, but they get half as much as the people who are sort of in the middle. And so that's the way that the Republican leadership is proposing it. There has been some criticism from within the Republican caucus about this. So some Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, are still questioning whether we should be doing direct payments at all. Other Republicans have been saying that this proposal is too regressive and we need to be giving more money to poor people. And then on the Democratic side, they also are saying, this isn't generous enough. One difference actually between what the Republican senators are proposing and what the Trump administration is proposing is that right now the Republican Senate proposal is just a one-time payment. And the Trump administration had proposed giving a little bit less money, but giving it in two installments. So it would actually be each payment would be less money, but it would be more money overall. And so that, I think, is going to be a sticking point, too, is can you just do a one-time payment? Or given that we have no idea how long this public health crisis is going to last, people might have to be out of work for a while. Does this have to be a recurring payment? And how does that affect, how much money we're giving people and how we're calibrating this? And does that need to change? So I think this is something that's going to continue to be debated. I do think there are some folks that I've talked to who have just said, the specifics at this point are less important than just getting the money to people quickly, because this is actually a thing we've done before. A tax rebate stimulus went out in 2008 because of the Great Recession, and it took about 2 months for those payments to go out. And I've been talking to folks about, you know, whether we could do it more quickly. I've heard a wide range of responses and estimates about how long that would take. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that, Tara. But, you know, if you're saying time is of the essence, obviously the longer it takes Congress to actually agree on something, the longer it'll be before money is in Americans' hands.
Yeah, Tara, how are you processing all of these complexities that Amelia's laid out?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts, and I think that that just adds to everybody's uncertainty, which for the macro economy is bad. You know, that's bad for individuals to not know how much money, when is it coming? Because even if they're not actually receiving the money yet, if they know it's coming, then maybe they can make a little bit better plans. Maybe they can be okay charging a little bit more to the credit card, knowing that some money is going to be coming to them, but not knowing when, what, how, all of those questions, I think, are very risky for individual planning. And then that aggregates up to the entire economy. That makes us all slow down and cut back on spending everywhere that we can. And when we do that, then that means that not only the people that are directly affected and are unable to go to work right now because of the virus, but all sorts of other people might be at risk of losing their jobs as well.
What's the ultimate goal here, Tara? Just to kind of have the government fill all the gaps in the economy for whatever 2 to 3 months, you know, and of course, I don't know that it's going to be 2 to 3 months, that this might take. I've heard the government referred to as like the buyer of last resort in this context, just filling in vast economic gaps, but knowing that it's going to be for a short period of time. Is that how people should be thinking of this?
Well, people are thinking about it a number of different ways. Again, since this is all new to us, we've got a bunch of different theories that are all, you know, bouncing around out there, and we're all trying to figure out which one's right. And we'll probably be studying this for many years afterwards, arguing and debating. I'm really looking forward to when this is just a historical period that we're all, you know, analyzing.
Amen, Tara. Amen.
Yeah. But, you know, right now when we're in it,
we should be so lucky as to be studying it.
Yes, yes. But for right now, when we're thinking about how do we, you know, take care of people now, protect the economy, make sure that there are jobs for people to go back to when we're able to go back into the economy, but also think about the fact that there are going to be some shifts that are going to go on, and we do want to reward innovation and people who are thinking about creative ways to still be working and producing in these difficult times. So we don't want to necessarily, you know, freeze the economy where it was before the pandemic. We want to have some incentives for people to, you know, come up with new product ideas and new ways to work from home, new entertainment options, all of that. We want to still have those incentives in place while still preserving as much of the economy that we think we'll want to go back to when we're able to go back. And because this is all so dramatic and sudden, we might have seen, you know, some of these shifts, you know, moving, you know, to ever more, you know, technologically supported activities. We might have seen that slowly happening over 5 years, and we might see it all happen in 2 months instead. Is there a way through policy that we can smooth that transition for people that maybe in 5 years would have had to shift jobs, but now we're telling them you need to leave your job today?
Do you see this dramatically changing the economics of healthcare?
You know, that's a tricky one. Again, early days, so it's still hard to see. But, you know, we do know that there's been a big push towards doing more telemedicine, even in the last few weeks. And that's been something that has been, you know, kind of that innovation on the horizon, using more technology for medicine. And there had been some slowness to adopt that. I think similarly in the education industry, I've seen that with my professor colleagues, where there had been a lot of pushback on adopting new technologies, in part because we were always busy, and I think doctors are always busy, and so, you know, investing in learning that new technology or investing in learning a new medical treatment, you can see why they would choose the medical treatment. But now that they have to choose, you know, they're going to learn this new technology whether they like it or not. Are they going to continue to use it and see advances that way? I think so.
We've been talking a little bit about the economy on the individual level. You said that the second bucket here is macroeconomics. What kinds of things should we expect there? Should we expect bailouts? What are the tools in the toolbox?
Yeah, well, so this is where we've got to talk about the Federal Reserve. So we've been talking a lot about the role of fiscal policy, and that's particularly important when we're concerned about distributional impacts and about, you know, supporting individuals, providing incentives for people to stay home when they should stay home. All those sorts of things are definitely in Congress's responsibility set, you know, obviously, you know, providing, you know, sick days, all of that is something that the Fed can't do. But in terms of supporting the broader macroeconomy, and in particular, making sure that this doesn't become another financial crisis on top of a health crisis, that's something where we've seen the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world working incredibly hard, pulling out all the stops in order to try and preserve the health of the financial side of the economy so that we can borrow from the future. And that's really important right now because, you know, what we're hoping is that this is a temporary stop and that we can borrow from the future when we're going to be able to go back and participate in the economy more normally. And that should help us to be able to smooth out the impact and not have a long-lasting economic decline.
Amelia, what are the politics of all of these potential solutions? Not necessarily the sticking points between Democrats and Republicans on the Hill, but more what the American public thinks. Do they like cash payments? I mean, you kind of assume that they would, but what do we see in the polling data? And, you know, post-2008, how do people feel about bailouts?
Yeah, so I've been keeping an eye on the polling, and, you know, I think listeners of the podcast will be familiar with this, but everything is moving very quickly. And so, you know, the cash payments are not even in a lot of the polls that I'm looking at. You know, they're asking about the things that we were talking about last week. And so I'm sure there are polls in the field that have questions about the cash payments, and we will know more about where Americans are on that. I will say I've seen one analysis from Data for Progress. And again, this is just one analysis. So, you know, we'll want to wait and see what other polls say. But they found that there was a big swing in support for sending checks to Americans from the beginning of March to just a few days ago. So on March 2nd, the idea of sending every American a $1,000 check was 15 percentage points underwater. So it was 33% of Americans supported it and 48% opposed. By March 17th, seen a huge change, 17-point swing to 58% support. So a solid majority and 26% opposed. So, you know, we'll see if that kind of swing is borne out in, you know, the next round of polls. I will say the scope of the crisis means that I think many people are going to know someone who has been directly affected by this and, you know, maybe wondering, even if I have the money for next month's rent, how am I going to pay the month after that? You know, I think the impact of what we've seen in terms of the job losses and hours being cut back in the past week, you know, certainly I think Americans will be very aware of what that looks like. So I wouldn't be surprised if people were supportive of sending checks. I will say in the polls I've seen also, there was generally pretty broad support for other measures like emergency paid leave of various lengths, providing free coronavirus testing, helping expand health insurance, because that's going to be an issue for the parts of the population that are uninsured or underinsured, making sure that like people actually will go to the doctor if they feel sick, you know, and when we ramp up testing, that's not going to be a financial hardship. The one thing that I saw in a few polls last week was less popular were bailouts of various industries, airlines, cruise ships, tourism, hotels. And, you know, one thing that you do see in polling from 2008, 2009 is that Americans just tend to be pretty skeptical of big bailouts of sort of, you know, giant industries like banks, even the auto industry. So I would expect some of that skepticism to, you know, or I would not be surprised if some of that skepticism carried over. Of course, that doesn't mean that we won't end up bailing out some of these industries or, you know, kind of helping them in various ways. But one thing that is getting some political discussion is trying to attach some strings to the any money or loans that would be extended to these industries, you know, that would sort of say, you know, maybe you don't give executives a raise for a certain period of time or, you know, and I'll be interested to see whether obviously, I don't think like the average American is tracking the intricacies of these policy moves. So I don't know if that's going to make anyone feel better about the idea of a bailout. But that is certainly, you know, one thing that could happen.
Yeah. At the press conference yesterday on Thursday, a reporter asked Trump if he was open to the government taking a stake in private companies that it helped with, you know, bailouts or loans or things like that. And he actually said yes, which was an interesting development. I'm not sure how thought through that is at this point. But Tara, wrapping up here, what lessons have we learned from 2008, 2009 about the appetite for bailouts, the efficacy of bailouts?
Yeah, well, so the problem is that specifically when we're thinking about businesses that are being directly affected by the coronavirus, this is something where, you know, if we're thinking about airlines, cruise ships, their business was fundamentally viable potentially until they were suddenly told to not have any more travel, and we were all told to not go on cruise ships and not stay in hotels and not go out to restaurants. Like all of these groups, their business model was fine. So that's very different than finding yourself in a situation where you're very over leveraged and then your demand drops and you get a bailout. Like that type of bailout, I think there was a lot of frustration on the part of the public for those, even though from a macroeconomic standpoint, in order to preserve jobs at these large companies, that might have provided some benefits. But on the other hand, today, do we expect that we will be going back to these businesses, that people will go back to working at them? And maybe this case is very different, and bailouts make sense in this case, again, to preserve those jobs and preserve those companies so that the economy is there when we're ready to go back to it.
Yeah, and I mean, I just add to that, Tara, that I've got a couple polls from 2008 when we were sending out these tax rebate checks that even then Americans actually didn't think they were going to be that helpful, and they were not necessarily that popular. And so I think, you know, obviously there are lessons to be learned from what happened in 2008, 2009, but I think the public's response to something like this, where literally we are telling people do not work, I mean, it's just so unprecedented that I think, you know, who knows what we'll see in terms of how people respond. I think it could be very different this time.
Yeah, well, and in some sense, if we're able to take care of the economy and everything looks good on the other side of this, then there might be a lot of complaints about policy overreaching. And yet it might be exactly that extreme measure that did make things okay on the other side.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We keep talking about how this is unprecedented. And so to a certain extent, looking at data sets, policies from past experiences don't help. I mean, Amelia and I were talking yesterday, like, okay, well, in another situation, you might expect a jobs program. But what kind of jobs program where people have to stay 6 feet away from each other, and a jobs program in the middle of a time when a lot of the jobs that were lost is because the government is asking people to stay in their homes? It's just so difficult to try to think through anything that compares to this moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's one reason why the policy response is so complicated, too, because, like, even our unemployment insurance system is set up to kind of try to get people to go back to work. You know, that's one reason why unemployment benefits do not replace your entire income, because the idea is it's sort of like a bridge between, you know, losing a job and finding another job. And so I've talked to several economists, you know, there's obviously a lot of debate over this, but, you know, I've talked to some people who have said, we need to be replacing people's income at a much higher level because we want to, like, flip around the message we're sending to people. We are saying to them, do not look for other jobs. We don't want you to go out and get, you know, whatever part-time job you can get right now. We want you to stay home. And so that, you know, I think that is just important to bear in mind, that a lot of the ways that we think about policy responses are just, they're just different right now in this moment.
Although if we do go that route and we end up being relatively long-term in this sort of structure, we may still want to have some incentives for people to be creative and find ways to work even during these difficult times. And so it is hard to figure out, like, if we're talking about just a few weeks versus a few months, that might be a really different set of incentives that we want to set out for people.
Right. Well, and that was one of the things Galen and I were talking about yesterday, too, is sort of like we're also facing, you know, what appear to be shortages of crucial medical supplies. And so, you know, do we want to figure out ways to get people out there actually producing the things we need in a sort of, you know, wartime sense of like we really want to ramp up certain industries? So I think that's just, you know, I don't know. There's like a message of this conversation. I think it's just everything is uncertain and everything is in flux. And, you know, we kind of have to see what happens over the next couple of weeks. And there are going to be multiple policy waves of responses to this.
Yeah.
You know, partially just in response to that reality.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that our listeners are not strangers to the word uncertainty. And I think that's going to be a theme of a lot of the conversations that we have going forward. And we're definitely going to keep checking back in on the data that we have about the economy and the political response. But let's leave it there for now. So thank you, Tara, so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Amelia.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.